Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. From Vice magazine, a woman was arrested after pretending to be a dentist for 8 years.
Oh.
I had no fear of dentistry before going in.
Oh, right. Yeah, it's already a pretty anxiety-laden topic, but to think that the person poking around in your mouth might not actually be a dentist? Whoo! Okay, so there was someone who claimed to be a dentist, but was actually just some random, unlicensed person. Specifically, this person was in Suffolk County in New York, and she was arrested for impersonating a fake dental practice that she operated out of her home.
Okay.
Maybe that we can call that red flag number one.
Yeah. Right?
I know commercial real estate is expensive, but... So, upon receiving a search warrant, investigators discovered that there were no licenses, no training records. So she is now facing 3 counts of unauthorized practice of a profession. Officials are asking for more patients of hers to come forward as they build up the case. The patients who already alerted the police realized after going to see her that something was off. She allegedly never used anesthesia.
What? Oh.
She used antibiotics from overseas. Yeah, it sounds funny, but patients are dealing with nerve damage and even facial paralysis after having her operate on them, because that can happen.
Well, and to be fair, if she hands you some pills, how are you going to know they came from overseas? The lack of anesthetic, however, that seems a little more obvious.
Now, the worst part of this, of course, wasn't that she was just some quick pop-up that got busted. She had been doing this for 8 years.
Wow.
Local news outlet WABC reports that officers believe she targeted lower class patients who didn't have dental insurance or enough money to cover traditional costs, which sigh. So if you go to the dentist, they're operating out of home, not giving you the anesthesia, shop around.
I mean, I'm sure she Googled.
Yeah, I can see the appeal, though. If you're like, listen, I can't afford a root canal. And she's like, look, I know how to do one. Just, this is between you and me. Give me a couple $100 cash. Like, I can see how she managed for 8 years now.
There are dental schools that will offer discounted, but, you know, and those can be kind of dicey. I know Bradley has his own experience with that as well. But at least you have some reassurance they are under supervision of someone who actually is a dentist, right?
So I'm guessing, too, she's worked on a lot of undocumented immigrants, which is why she could survive for so long, because they can't tell anybody.
Yep. Yeah. This isn't her being like, oh, this will be a fun con. She's like, no, I can make money at this and people will come. Okay.
Yep.
It makes it sound like I'm considering it, but I'm not, I promise.
You know, you speak so well. I might be convinced if I were just to have a conversation with you, but just don't do it out of your home. You'll get caught. Okay. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Popular Science. It's titled The Illusory Reality of World War I Dazzle Camouflage Reexamined.
Ooh.
Okay.
That sounds fabulous.
It is. And there's some nice photos here as well. It's about the dazzle wraps that they would put on ships as an optical illusion. So during World War I, Allied navies started implementing shocking cubist-inspired dazzle paint jobs on ships. The now iconic geometric designs were intended to throw off the visual perception of German U-boat crews and prevent them from accurately targeting ships with torpedoes. Conventional wisdom claims the bizarre camouflage pattern worked and helped turn the tide of Great War naval battles. But new research reevaluating one of the only rigorous studies testing that hypothesis suggests those conclusions were probably overblown.
Like, it was not worth it. You just made your ship look stupid for no reason.
Yeah. I mean, there were some upsides, which we'll get into, but they're not the ones that were usually claimed, according to this research. So researchers now claim another phenomenon known as the horizon effect may have actually done more to throw off submarine gunners than the wacky aesthetic. Researchers write, these reappraised findings resolve an apparent conflict with the second quantitative experiment on Dazzle ships conducted over a century later using computer displays online. The Dazzle paint scheme originated around 1917 as a direct response to unyielding German U-boat attacks. German ships famously adopted an unrestricted submarine war policy at the start of the year, which reportedly resulted in hundreds of sunken ships, both military and merchant, in less than 1 year. Looking for a solution, English artist Norman Wilkinson approached Britain's King George V with models of ships adorned in zigzag and checkered patterns in shades of gray, black, white, green, orange, and blue. Wilkinson claimed these odd shapes, when viewed from a distance through a U-boat periscope, would distort the ship's appearance just enough to make it difficult for submarine operators to accurately track and target them with torpedoes. Convinced by the demonstration, King George approved the implementation of Dazzle designs across the British fleet. Wilkinson's Dazzle approach followed on the heels of other less practical proposals. Shipmakers had reportedly tried at various times to cloak vessels in mirrors and paint them to resemble giant clouds and whales.
Aww.
American inventor Thomas Edison even reportedly pushed forward an idea to reconfigure the ships to look like floating islands lush with foliage. All of these ideas ultimately failed because they couldn't account for the constantly changing environments and weather conditions at sea.
Mm.
It simply wasn't possible to fully camouflage a ship in a way that consistently blended it into its surroundings. Dazzle took an entirely different approach. Rather than trying to disappear, the unorthodox geometric shapes aimed to confuse an observer's perception of a ship's movement and orientation from a distance. So, though widely adopted by both British and American vessels during the war, Dazzle camouflage was mostly implemented based on assumption rather than solid evidence. One of the only remaining quantitative studies on its effectiveness was conducted in 1919 by an MIT naval architecture and marine engineering student named Leo Blodgett as part of his thesis. In the study, Blodgett painted model ships with Dazzle patterns and placed them in a mock battle theater. He then observed them at a distance through a periscope and claimed the Dazzle effect confused the observer's perception of the ship's movement. But when the Aston University researchers looked back over the findings, they found several holes in the study, notably in Blodgett's control group, that didn't measure up to modern standards. The Aston researchers went back in and created a new control experiment based on edited images of the original results. The newly improved methods showed the optical illusions occurring in cases where the ships did and did not have the Dazzle paint. So, hearing about his actual original study, it's kind of just like one guy with a diorama and a lens, and he's like, yeah, that looks confusing.
I mean, he's a grad student. He's got to work with what he's got, you know?
Totally. And I mean, even the guy who originally proposed it, it was almost entirely vibes-based. He's like, yeah, you know, this should work. And the king was like, yeah, great.
I mean, listen, if you got people dying every day and the first six things you tried haven't worked, you're going to be like, try this, whatever. Like, let's get
That's
going.
Right. Yeah, sometimes totally. The vibes have to get really urgent.
Yes.
Pressing vibes. So, revealing as the findings are, they don't necessarily mean Dazzle was completely ineffective. As noted in a 2016 Smithsonian report, merchant ships clad with the Dazzle pattern during the war were reportedly granted lower insurance premiums. Some ship captains also claimed crew morale appeared higher on ships with the Dazzle pattern than those without.
Hey, livery matters. Just ask F1.
Well, and I think also the clearest evidence that we kind of know in our hearts that it didn't work is that we don't do it today. I feel like if it worked that great, we would still be painting all our ships like that. So,
yeah.
I think, too, we're not looking at things anymore. We just radar it.
That's true. Maybe they're like, it doesn't matter. That's fair.
Right. The Dazzle camouflage is going to be scrambling, showing up on or not showing up on radars, right?
Yeah. We need radar Dazzle. I couldn't make the words come out.
I mean, yeah, that's Razzle.
Yeah, I mean, razzle dazzle is what my brain was trying to say, and it wouldn't work.
Next link?
Next link!
This comes from The Conversation. Researchers created sound that can bend itself through space.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Ooh.
Wait, like targeted sound precision?
Yeah, so the newly published research introduces a way to create audible enclaves, localized pockets of sound that are isolated from their surroundings. In other words, they're developing a technology that could create sound exactly where it needs to be. They already have sound that does that. So there are certain audio technologies. It's called parametric array loudspeakers that create a focused beam. In our field, we call it beamforming audio. If you all ever go to the Sphere,
Oh, in Vegas?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So if you're on the right side, you could be listening to a French broadcast. Move 20 feet over to your left,
what?
And it's German. Move another 20 feet over. It's remarkable, but it is still linear. So if you go forwards and backwards, it's still going to be the same
right.
in the beamforming. But they found a new way to send sound to one specific listener, though, through self-bending ultrasound beams and a concept called nonlinear acoustics. So ultrasound refers to sound waves that are beyond our human range, which is 20K, though if you're over 18, you can't hear 20 kilohertz anymore.
My hearing's gone way down. I can't hear a lot of the high frequencies anymore.
These waves travel through the air like normal sound waves, but are inaudible to people. In their work, they used ultrasound as a carrier for audible sound. It can transport sound through space silently, becoming audible only when desired. So how do they do this? Normally, sound waves combine linearly. They just proportionally add up into a bigger wave. However, sometimes when waves are intense enough, they can interact non-linearly, generating new frequencies that weren't present before. We'll call those harmonics and overtones in our field. This is the key to their technique. They use two ultrasound beams at different frequencies that are completely silent on their own, but when they intersect in space, nonlinear effects cause them to generate a new sound wave at an audible frequency that would be heard in that specific region.
Okay.
Crucially, by using acoustic metasurfaces, they can shape the beams to bend as they travel. This is kind of similar to how we can bend light with optical lenses. It's kind of a similar with acoustic. By precisely controlling the phase of the ultrasound waves, they create a curved sound path that can navigate around obstacles and meet at a specific target location. The key phenomenon at play here is called difference frequency generation. So when two ultrasonic beams of slightly different frequencies, such as 40K and 39.5K, overlap, they create a new sound wave at a different frequency between their frequencies. In this case, it would be 0.5 kilohertz or 500 hertz, which we can hear. Sound can be heard only where the beams cross. Outside of the intersection, the ultrasound waves will remain silent to us.
Right. Yeah. Dogs will not love this display.
Right. 60 cats can hear. Dolphins go all the way up to 120. Yeah.
Wow.
So this is loud for cats and who knows with birds, but it's still neat.
Yeah.
As long as we're thinking about ourselves, it's great.
Yeah. Well, it has potential applications. You can do it inside, like museums. You walk in front of a painting and you only get that sound specifically in front of that.
I will note, they have stuff like that. The way they've done it is just they point the sound downward. So instead of coming at you, it's up in the ceiling and you step underneath it and you can, there is a real shocking difference. And the way they're just taking advantage of the fact that there's a floor.
Yeah, there's some things like, guys, we can kind of do some of this stuff already.
Yeah. But and it's not nearly as expensive.
But this, exactly. And this is a very specific application, right? I can see it being more used for military applications more than anything else, for crowd dispersal, for making somebody feel like they're going insane because they can only hear the whisper.
For secret agent reactivations. Sleeper
but
cells.
There's still a lot of challenges. One, as you mentioned, it's expensive. And nonlinear distortion can affect sound quality, kind of something we all deal with as audio engineers. And power efficiency is another issue. Converting the ultrasound to audible sound, it requires a lot of power. But despite the hurdles, they're going to continue to work on it.
They're like, we can do it. And that's step one.
Yeah. Again, my main issue is what it's doing beyond the frequency ranges that we can hear. Like, cool for us, but...
Well, and I feel like surely you could eventually get ear damage even in frequencies you can't hear.
Right, or some other DNA change.
Yeah, that too.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, next up, we've got a little bit of a medical mystery from Vice.com, and it's called Man Had the Hiccups for 2 Years Before Doctors Finally Cured Him.
Oy.
Yeah. So one of the things we know about hiccups is that we don't know a whole lot. They can be caused by a ton of different conditions and substances and weird environmental triggers. And it's really hard to study them because they are so transient. Like, the average person is maybe going to get the hiccups a couple of times a year, and then they go away pretty fast, so there's not a lot of motivation to devote resources toward researching hiccups when there's things like, you know, cancer to be solved. But there have been a number of cases where people have extended continuous hiccups. I feel like we actually talked about another one of them recently. And those are a great opportunity for us to discover a new but still pretty inexplicable reason for why that might happen. So in this case, there was a 93-year-old man in Lebanon who reportedly had been having hiccups for 2 years straight. They did fade occasionally, but then a day or two later, they'd be back. Ugh. And the doctors around him tried a lot of things to make them stop. They gave him muscle relaxers and protein pump inhibitors and even antipsychotics, but nothing made a difference. And eventually, he ended up getting admitted to the hospital, not specifically for the hiccups, but for fatigue, which they were like, well, yeah, your constant muscle spasms might have something to do with that. But this time, instead of trying to cure the hiccups, they did a full medical workup, like, let's pretend we don't know about the hiccups and just see what's wrong with you. And it turned out he was surprisingly healthy for a 93-year-old man. His thyroid was a little weak, his cholesterol was a little high, but, you know, he was already on medications for those and they were well controlled. He had no parasites, no digestive problems, no cognitive issues. The only thing that showed up on his lab work, and it showed up like a beacon, was his eosinophil count was through the roof.
Oh, that eosinophil count.
I know, right? You got to look out for that. So eosinophils are a white blood cell that protects against parasitic infection. And in a normal person, they tend to hover around 1% to 4% of your total white blood cell count. They're not that important, basically. This guy's were at 18%. Which was especially weird because, number one, again, he did not have a parasitic infection. But number two, with an eosinophil count that high, he should have had a secondary problem called eosinophilic esophagitis. Because if you have too many eosinophils in your bloodstream, they tend to accumulate in your esophagus. And it causes symptoms like vomiting and heartburn and trouble swallowing. And usually when you have EE but don't have a parasitic infection, it's because of like food allergies or some other kind of immune dysfunction. But again, the guy had no allergies and none of the symptoms that he should have had given how high his eosinophil count was. They even did a full endoscopy, sticking a camera all the way down to his stomach looking for any kind of inflammation, and there just wasn't any.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were like, it's out of range. Let's see what happens if we bring it in range. So they gave him a topical steroid cream, and lo and behold, the hiccups went away.
What?
And they don't know why.
What? Wow.
Their best guess is that maybe the eosinophils were building up in his esophagus, but the inflammation was somehow radiating outward into the rest of his body instead of inward into the cavity where we could see it. And maybe it was bumping up against the vagal nerve, which controls the diaphragm, and that's what was causing the misfires. Huh. But the short version is they have no idea why it worked. Wow. The case study simply concludes that we should add topical steroids to the list of random things to try if someone is having intractable hiccups.
I mean, steroids is like the Hail Mary for any medical situation.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to do the job a lot.
Yeah, well, and the problem is with something like eosinophilic esophagitis, it's a chronic condition. You have to stay on something forever. So like he's 93, whatever. He can take a bunch of steroids. But if you've got a younger person with this, they can't be on steroids for their whole lives. Like it's a problem. So it's not really a solution, even if this is the one weird reason you have hiccups. The author got kind of dark in this article, and the opening was like, if I've had hiccups for more than a minute, I feel like life isn't worth living. So he obviously finds them very annoying, but this man lived with it, so...
Sheesh.
Next link?
Next link!
All right, from the conversation, did you know that chewing gum is not a litter problem? It's plastic pollution.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Any chewing gum fans out here?
Listen, I say that as someone with a piece of gum in my mouth right now. So, okay.
Wait, you're recording with gum in your mouth?
I know. I'm bad. I'm a bad podcaster.
You're gifted. You're gifted. But I do hate to break it to you. Thousands of tons of plastic pollution could be escaping into the environment every year from our mouths. And this is because most chewing gum is made from a variety of oil-based synthetic rubbers, similar to the plastic material used in car tires.
Cool.
I know. So if you found that thought slightly unsettling, you're not alone. The author of this article had been researching and speaking about the plastic pollution problem for 15 years, and the people that they talk to are almost always surprised and disgusted when they find out they've been chewing on a lump of malleable plastic. And part of this is because most manufacturers just don't advertise what gum is actually made of. If you look at the ingredient list, you'll see how they dodge around the detail by listing gum base in the ingredients.
Oh.
And there's no strict definition of synthetic gum base. Wrigley chewing gum brand partners with dental professionals around the world to promote the use of sugar-free chewing gum to improve oral health. And the brand's Wrigley Oral Health Program states, and this is just PR, so hang on, gum base puts the chew in chewing gum, binding all the ingredients together for a smooth, soft texture. We use synthetic gum base materials for a consistent and safe base that provides longer lasting flavor, improved texture, and reduced tackiness. Almost sounds harmless, but chemical analysis shows that gum contains styrene butadiene, which is the durable synthetic chemical used to make car tires. It also has polyethylene, the plastic used to make carrier bags and bottles, and polyvinyl acetate, wood glue, as well as, you know, sweetener and flavoring.
The good parts. Yeah, don't forget those.
Well, we're just going to, you know, dodge those by referring to them as gum base in this one here too, right? If the idea of chewing plastic doesn't gross you out, consider what happens after you spit it out. And this does explain why gum spat out in situ in the world does seem to last forever. Like other plastics, synthetic chewing gum does not biodegrade. It can persist in the environment for many years. And it may harden, crack, or break down into microplastics in the environment, but this can take decades. And cleaning it up is not cheap because it takes a lot of labor unless we can get the robots to do it, right? The average cost is about 1.5 pounds per square meter. We're in Britishies here. And estimates suggest that the annual cleanup cost for chewing gum pollution for councils in the UK, around 7 million pounds. There have been some efforts to address the problem. In some public locations around the UK, gum collection pots supplied by a Dutch company called Gumdrop Limited, they've been installed to collect and recycle gum.
Oh.
Yeah. Signage provided by councils encouraging responsible disposal is also now a regular feature in some UK high streets, and there is a growing number of small producers offering plant-based alternatives. Spoiler alert, most of them are derived from chicle, like little chicle gums that you may be familiar with in, like, you know, the bodegas. Yeah, turns out those weren't plastic. So in the UK, the environmental charity Keep Britain Tidy launched the Chewing Gum Task Force in 2021. The collaboration involves three major manufacturers who have all committed to investing up to £10 million in order to clean up historic gum staining and changing behavior so that more people bin their gum. But here lies the crux of the issue. The first objective implies that cleaning up gum is a solution to this form of plastic pollution. It's not, because manufacturers making a financial contribution to cleanup efforts is like plastic manufacturers paying for litter pickers and bin bags at volunteer beach cleans. Neither addresses the root cause of the problem, which is gum from a plastic is still being produced and chewed. And finally, the researcher points to definition as another issue. In the two annual reports published by the Gum Litter Task Force since inception, there is no mention of the word pollution. And the distinction between litter and pollution is important because if you call it pollution, the narrative changes from an individual negligence issue to a corporate one. And that places the onus for accountability on the producers rather than the consumers.
And they usually own up to their...
Oh, yeah, that always gets the kind of effects we're looking for, especially in highly unregulated administration environments, right? But listen, to think about chewing gum as a single-use plastic, that just changes everything.
No, it's depressing. Yeah, I don't love it. I'm getting called out here. It's fine.
It's not just you. And I have to confess, I was a habitual gum eater when I was a little kid. I think I understand better that stat of we all have microplastics in our body that amount to like a spoon's worth in our brain alone. I probably have like a full set just with all the
Right, of all the- of my life.
So, you know, they're thinking of what, transparent labeling, maybe we have better regulations, you know, a lot of this is kind of pie in the sky stuff.
I mean, it's a fact. Singapore completely outlawed gum.
Yeah.
Like they were like, it's too much of an issue. We're making it 100% illegal. And the punishment is severe.
It like, is. And it felt like really such a big overreach. Deal. Like the gum thing in Singapore used to be like, this is how intensely anti-rights they are. But boy, maybe they were hip to this plastic pollution thing before we were. Whew. All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Popular Mechanics. It's titled, Oops, scientists may have severely miscalculated how many humans are on Earth.
I'm hoping the oops number is smaller.
Yeah, good luck.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they don't ever give a specific number or scale, but we'll dig into some of the details here. I do like the byline of this article. We've got to start counting from one again.
Up to 8 billion.
Yeah. Well, more.
More. Yeah, not 8 billion now.
Yeah, so Homo sapiens is the most successful mammalian species in Earth history, and it's not even close. However, a new study suggests that the impressive nature of humanity's proliferation may have been vastly underreported. Most estimates place Earth's human population at around 8.2 billion, but Josias Lang-Ritter, a postdoctoral researcher at Aalto University in Finland and lead author of the study published in the journal Nature Communications, claims that these estimates could be underrepresenting rural areas by a significant margin. Depending on the data set, rural populations have been underestimated by between 53% to 84% over the period studied.
What?
Wow.
The results are remarkable, as these data sets have been used in thousands of studies and extensively support decision making, yet their accuracy has not been systematically evaluated. So, how exactly do you test the accuracy of global data sets used to derive population totals in the first place? Well, with a background in water resource management, Lang-Ritter looked at the different kind of population data gathered from rural dam projects, 300 such projects across 35 countries, to be precise. This data focused on the years 1975 to 2010, and these population tallies provided a significant data set to check against other population totals calculated by organizations like WorldPop, GWP, GRUMP, LandScan, and GHSPOP, which were also analyzed in this study. Lang-Ritter said in a press statement, "When dams are built, large areas are flooded and people need to be relocated. The relocated population is usually counted precisely because dam companies pay compensation to those affected." Unlike global population datasets, such local impact statements provide comprehensive, on-the-ground population counts that are not skewed by administrative boundaries. We combine these with spatial information from satellite imagery. Part of this discrepancy likely stems from the fact that many countries don't have the resources for precise data collection, and difficulty traveling to far-flung rural areas only exacerbates census counting discrepancies. Mm-hmm. A widespread underrepresentation of rural populations could have profound impacts on those communities, as censuses are central to figuring out how to divvy up resources. Mm-hmm. However, not everyone is convinced by this research. Stuart Geedle Bastin from the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology told New Scientist that while increased investment in rural population data collection would be beneficial, the idea that Earth could contain a few billion more human inhabitants than we thought is extremely unlikely.
Yeah, it's an extrapolation for sure. And, you know, it's got some reasonable theories of like, hey, we really aren't doing a good job counting these particular areas. But it also feels like maybe it's saying, so if it's here, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's true. What they need to do is get the satellites involved in a much more accurate way where it's like, okay.
Stop. We already have Starlink and Tesla everywhere. Our surveillance nation is already in place. Do not encourage them any further.
I know, but remember Hands Across America? Like, if we could just tell everybody, all right, at this time, you're going to stand outside and we're all going to look down and count the heads.
That's right. It's definitely not going to shoot you with our drones or anything like that. Just everybody come outside this time.
I think we should all just get a personal satellite assigned to us at birth. And then that's how we keep track.
Well, they're called personal angels, but we can agree to disagree.
Next link.
Next link.
This also comes from The Conversation. It's a little tough one. Why history instruction is critical for combating online misinformation.
Oh, critical, but is it effective? Like, I don't know.
So for years, some commentators have called for K through 12 teachers to take on fake news or online information by doubling down on critical thinking. This push for schools to do a better job preparing young people to differentiate between low and high quality information often focuses on social studies classes. So first, the bad news. When people demand that schools teach critical thinking, it's not always clear what they mean. Some people might consider critical thinking a trait or capacity that teachers can encourage, like creativity or grit. They could believe that critical thinking is a mindset, a habit of being curious, skeptical, or reflective, or they might be referring to a specific skill. For instance, that students should learn a set of steps to take to assess information online.
Mm.
Unfortunately, cognitive science research has shown that critical thinking is not an abstract quality or practice that can be developed on its own. Cognitive scientists see critical thinking as a specific kind of reasoning that involves problem solving and making sound judgments. Mm-hmm. It can be learned, but it relies on specific content knowledge and does not necessarily transfer between fields.
Mm.
So early studies on chess players and physicists, you know, real dummies,
right,
in the 1970s and 80s helped show how the kind of flexible and reflective cognition often called critical thinking is really a product of expertise. Chess masters, for instance, don't start out with innate talent. In most cases, they gain expertise by hours of thoughtfully playing the game. However, research has found that being a great chess player does not make people better at other kinds of complex critical thinking. Since context is key to critical thinking, learning to analyze information about current events likely requires knowledge about politics and history. Fortunately, that's where social studies classes, that's what those were for. I don't know if you guys had social studies.
Well, I can say in my own experience, they were all taught by coaches. Like, social studies was very much considered to be the place where you dump the coach because somebody's got to teach the social studies class, but who cares? So, like, I don't know. I'm bitter about my social studies education for sure.
Right. The author's research has shown that high school students can make relatively quick progress on some of the surface features of historical thinking, such as learning to check a text date and the author. But the deep questioning involved in true historical thinking is much harder to learn. All literacy relies on what readers already know. So for people wading through political information and news, knowledge about history and civics is like a key in the ignition for their analytical skills.
But it's so easy to do when all it takes for misinformation to become misinformation is to divorce it from the context, which is basically put it online and you're almost guaranteed that it's going to be divorced from context.
Right. Or just change the context, literally change the date and the author. And then it becomes really hard to be like, well, supposedly this came from somebody I trust. Like it's,
Right. It gets very tough and it's getting tougher now, right? Because it is a tenuous moment for history education. For what it's worth, the Bush and Obama era emphasis on math and English testing resulted in a decreased instructional time in history classes, particularly in elementary and middle schools. 27% of schools reported reducing social studies time in favor of subjects on state exams.
Well, and there also comes a critical mass. Like, there comes a point where it's not fair to say you need to be an expert in everything. And if we could get past that and be like, okay, I instead of learning critical thinking, just learn a little humility and say, I don't know about that. So I'm not going to have an opinion on it. But asking people to not have an opinion is not the American way.
And I'm not going to dedicate enough time in my life to become a brain surgeon. So.
Yeah, not going to happen. I can tell you that right now. Not for you, for me.
Give up, Bradley.
Yeah. Believe me, we know.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I have a short quickie here in the category of dumb criminals, which is always fun. This one comes from the BBC. It's called Earrings Worth $769,500 Recovered by Florida Police After Alleged Thief Swallows Them.
So critical thinking skills.
Yeah.
Just like the movies.
So, you know, pretty simple story. Basically, a man named Jathan Gilder walked into a Tiffany jewelry store in Orlando, Florida on February 26th. He claimed to be a personal assistant to an NBA player looking to pick up some jewelry on his rich client's behalf. So they took him into the VIP room, at which point he distracted employees, snatched up a handful of items, and ran out the door. And he actually dropped one of the things he grabbed, which was a diamond ring worth just under $600,000.
Oh my gosh.
But he got away with two pairs of diamond earrings worth a total of almost $800,000. And they have pictures of them. It's baffling to me how each of these four earrings is worth $200,000. I mean, it's a
stupid
diamond, but it's small enough to swallow. So, you know, you do the math. And of course, they've got cameras in the store and police caught up with the guy just a couple of hours later. And when he saw the cops coming toward him, officers say they saw him shove something in his mouth and work very hard to swallow it. The thing is, they saw him do it, but he also knew they saw him do it. Like, there was steady eye contact the whole time. So they put him in handcuffs, at which point he said to them, quote, I should have thrown him out the window. And, you know, probably he was in a fair amount of pain at that point, because I doubt he had a bottle of water. He was dry swallowing these sharp metal objects, just immediate regret. And just to make sure his confession was rock solid, when he was booked in at the police station, he asked, am I going to be charged with what's in my stomach?
Right. Do I get to keep this contraband when I go to jail?
Yeah, exactly. Like, we all know.
Because this will buy me a lot of cigarettes.
So the Orlando Police Department took him to a local hospital and got an x-ray showing the presence of a foreign object, at which point police and hospital staff simply monitored him until they were recovered. And it took a while. The fourth earring did not emerge until March 12th, which was 2 weeks after he'd swallowed them. Detective Aaron Goss referred to the process as a marathon, not a sprint. And once all four earrings were professionally cleaned, the store's master jeweler confirmed that the serial numbers on the earrings excreted by Mr. Gilder did, in fact, match the numbers of the stolen items.
Oh, I want somebody to buy those earrings.
Yeah, no. And they've got, like, you can see the picture. So you're like, I know what model that is. No one's going to buy that type of earring in Orlando for a long time.
Oh, these Florida people, someone's going to put a premium on those specifically. I guarantee
it. That could be.
They're worth more now. They've been double processed.
Oh. It's like the coffee beans that, like, go through the digestive tract of the weird cats. Yeah. They also confirmed that Mr. Gilder had a previous conviction in 2022 for robbing a Tiffany jewelry store in Texas. And there are no less than 48 warrants out for his arrest in Colorado.
Wow.
With his hospital stay now complete, he is in custody at the Orange County Jail. Maybe they'll send him to those other states, too. It seems clear he's not going to get out of prison again. But also, like, he had 48 warrants and somehow he was walking around in Florida. So I don't know. I feel like he's done the swallowing before.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's why he thought it was going to work.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Wow. He had good taste. I mean, he kept targeting Tiffany, too.
Good taste, but...
I didn't even mean to do that.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles that we did not have time to get to today include NASA's plutonium problem, was a mushroom behind an ALS outbreak in the Alps, and the cult of the American lawn. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInterestingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.